I work on bacteria for almost 25 years on the collective behavior of bacteria or social behavior. And reading about cancer, I started to be interested in cancer about 3 or even 5 years ago. I started reading and I realized that there are many indications that cancer is also conducting a collective behavior, social behavior. And reading more into the literature, I realized that there are many parallels between bacteria and cancer. So I started to look to what extent we can identify the parallels in a better way, and to what extent we can learn from what we know about bacteria to guide us to the collective behavior of cancer. That was the beginning. That helped us on different levels. We both conduct experiments on cancer. For example, the migration, which is a very essential part of the metastasis process. And we also conduct theoretical studies of the cancer decision or self-aid determination. For example, again, in the context of metastasis, the transition between epithelial and mesenchymal. Doing these studies, I also extended my interest, and what I presented today was something very new. We even didn't publish it, and this is to try to understand the identity of cancer. This also had some link to what we did in bacteria. The strains of bacteria that I developed, one strain, is marked by a very special ability to change or switch its identity. And that led me to think about the identity of the cancer cells. And looking at recent experiments that were presented here in the lecture, that you can transfer the nucleus from a cancer cell into a normal cell, and the cell will have a normal cell characteristics, or take a normal cell nucleus into a cancer cell, and the cell will remain cancer. And this raises the question, what is the identity? Is the identity in the nucleus, in the mitochondria? How the information is transferred? And I think this is some puzzle, the very fundamental puzzle of the cancer identity paradox. And I presented some idea that I came across how to resolve this paradox by linking into a problem of prion-like assembly.
Yes, that was particularly interesting and I think took everyone by surprise, because we associate prion with disease, of course, but you were saying that prions are part of our bodies, we need them anyhow, then for cancer, they, you can use them in particular ways.
That's true. I felt that is very exciting, because the most widely used drug for diabetes 2, which is called metformin, that is now being proposed to be used and have anti-tumor effect. And that was really surprising for me, and I couldn't understand why. What is the connection? There is a trivial connection between cancer and the diabetes because of cancer metabolism, that it uses more sugar in a popular way. Cancer love candies, sweets.
Because naively, you just think that this particular drug would lower the sugar and so the cancer would go away. But you're saying there's a different mechanism.
Exactly. But then people did some more than that. And in particular, it affects the cancer stem-like cells. And I tried to think, what is the connection? Is there a deeper connection? And how can I get a clue? So after I did the study on Google, and I didn't find any hints that could help me to understand what's going on, I asked the question, let's go back to the plant that secretes this compound, the French lilac.
And it secretes the anti-diabetic drug?
Yeah, the metformin. And I tried to think, what is it? Clearly, the plant didn't develop this for our benefit to fight diabetes or to fight cancer. So I tried to think, what is the reason? And because of comparison with another drug that is a compound that is produced by bacteria that I happen to know, I assume that it is used by the plants to fight parasites. But again, I couldn't find any confirmation for this assumption. So I decided to do a search and try to see if by some good luck someone tried to study if metformin has an effect against malaria. And to my delight, I discovered that it was studied, and they showed that it does have effect against malaria. Then I studied and discovered that about 20 compounds that people studied that act against malaria, and they did check the anti-tumor capabilities, showed anti-tumor capabilities.
That's amazing. So drugs like artemisinin.
That is, by the way, this plant goes all the way back to the Bible. It's mentioned that it's good for you. It's very popular in Israel for different things. And quinine, how you call it, it also has anti-cancer. So then I tried to think more about the parallels between malaria and cancer, and I realized that it has to do with the metabolism, because the parasite, when it invades a cell, has to change the way that the mitochondria of the host cell function, so they will produce more energy for the parasite to replicate and develop more parasites, and that it also has to change the function of its own mitochondria, because it doesn't depend on the energy production. And then I went and tried to look what are the parallels between malaria. I knew that malaria is associated with higher level of iron. So I did search and I found that it's known, but somehow it's not a main part of the discussion, that one of the hallmarks of cancer is a much significant higher level of iron, and it has a special mechanism to maintain the iron level.
Is that so it can just carry more oxygen?
The reason for the iron is, and this brings us back to the topic of this meeting, the Warburg effect and the mitochondria and the cancer metabolism, because people focus on the fact that cancer depends less on production of energy from the mitochondria. The Warburg effect, that even in the presence of oxygen, it can do fermentation. So that's why it needs the sugar, the glucose. But the iron level is associated with the fact that at the same time, there is the other part of the Warburg effect, the complementary part that is equally important, that it also makes the respiration or oxidation, energy production by aerobic process of the mitochondria more effective. So it elevates the iron level. It also elevates the reactive oxygen species, the ROS. It's true that the ROS are toxic to the cell, but part of the strategy of cancer is to replicate very fast. And if some cells die, that's fine. So cancer in the tumor cells replicate all the time, and some of them or many of them die also. Okay, so once I realized these things, that these parallels, and there are some other parallels, I also discovered that the malaria, people did study, and it has much more or higher fraction of proteins that have a prion-like properties, and they can change their assembly. And then I looked closer into what is known about prions in normal cells. And in particular, what you find is that prions are used in normal cells in order to go through phenotypic changes when they have exposed to stress. It's not normal cells in the body so much, but if you go to older atavistic cells, eukaryotic but more primitive cells, it's used even more frequently. And if you take the Paul and Charlie idea of going back in the method, that brings to mind that that's something which is very essential. Now, in particular, people did study, and there is a very nice paper in Cell from 2012, the changes on the function of the mitochondria if you change assembly of proteins which are prion-like, because it can change the way they function on the surface of the mitochondria. It can change the protein-protein interaction in the bulk. And the most important thing is that the prion-like protein can be infectious. You can transfer to other cells. And then I discovered that malaria caused the host cell to produce exosomes with prions-like protein that are then released and infect other cells, and then they change the other cells in a way that paved the way for the parasite to invade these other cells, and they are prepared for the parasite to come in and benefit from the changes. We know that cancer cells also send prions. They also have gap junctions. So I thought about the idea that maybe cancer use the same thing. And then once you accept the idea of the prion-like protein, it can help to resolve the paradox of the identity, because some of the characteristics and the special properties can be transferred or infected by the protein-like. So when you transfer the nucleus from another cell into cancer cell, it's not only the mitochondria that are different, but also you have there the prion-like, which are very essential for changing the regulatory pathways, and then they cause or maybe induce some genome plasticity and mutation in a specific direction that fits the selection which is imposed by this prion-like structure. So you have the information that can help the mutation to occur in a specific way. So it's not a random mutation, it's stochastic but not random.
Are you saying that prions can actually help cancer cells spread around the body?
I think that the prion helps the cancer cell to spread, but it can also help the cancer cell to maintain some identity, which is very important. And it might be used by the cancer cell to infect nearby stromal cell, so they will change the way they function. We know that some cases stromal cell change their identity and start to produce energy in a way that helps the cancer cells. It's called the reverse Warburg effect, and maybe this is the way it does. So if you have exosome with prion-like, it can be also something like cancerability, or the ability to develop specific cancer, increase the level. There are some indirect evidence that support this very alarming possibility.
Because then, of course, cancer would be spreadable between individuals.
Yeah, not the cancer will spread, but the cancerability, the ability to develop cancer. So it's less alarming than if cancer itself will spread. It's still alarming. In normal cells, we know that the prion assembly, the prion-like of protein, can be reversed. So we might want to look and learn how they are reversed back to normal. And that can be another way that we can fight cancer. This is obvious conclusion. So I didn't mention another thing that now that we talk in a relaxed way under the trees, I remember, I didn't mention that there are evidences that P53 form prion-like assembly.
And so just to be absolutely clear, the prions that you're talking about, you're saying that we have normal prion-like structures that help our normal cells in the body, and the ones that are supporting cancer cells have changed, they're a little bit different.
Yeah, they change the conformation. It's a little bit, but this is a singular perturbation. The little bit can cause, because they aggregate together, and it can cause other protein to change the conformation. So it's a little bit that can have a very, very strong consequences, far-reaching consequence. And that's why it's called in mathematics singular perturbation.